Hello, everybody. I just fully nearly got run over by a skateboarder. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Galactic Yo-Yo. I'm your host, Molly Martian. Podcast coming at you even later this week. Sorry I'm such a fuck-up, everybody. How are we all? We've had a trailer this week. We don't talk about that in the episode because when I recorded it, it hadn't come out yet. Also, Ambulance. Also, we speculate about Stephen Moffat writing for the new series in our conversation. And obviously now we know that those rumours were true. So there you go. But no, I was in Manchester last weekend and I was there to see family and stuff. And I took the opportunity while I was there to head over and talk to Tom Burgess, who is a wonderful comedian. And he works behind the scenes on Blue Peter, but most importantly, he's an enormous Doctor Who fan. So I wanted to talk to him about growing up with Doctor Who, working on Blue Peter, the relationship between those two shows, and also his comedy character, Peter Fleming, who is a sort of fictitious... Oh, the skateboards are out in droves today. He's a sort of fictitious BBC personality. And the most recent Peter Fleming show that Thomas put together is all about Doctor Who. So I wanted to pick his brains about that. Thank you so much to Tom yet again for kindly offering up his flat for us to record in. The audio this week is a little peaky. I think, to be honest, I was feeling a little frazzled by wanting everything to go smoothly in Tom's flat, so the levels are a bit iffy. I've done my best to mitigate that in post, but I haven't always pulled it off. So if I sound, there's a bit of distortion here and there, particularly on my mic, I'm sorry, everybody. Back with another episode next week, which is super exciting. I'm really chuffed with it. And it is, I won't spoil it, I'll just tell you it's the most expensive episode of Galactic Yo-Yo I've ever made. But yes, I guess, is that all the admin? Yeah, Doctor Who edges ever nearer. New Doctor Who. Don't get me wrong, there was stuff to love in the trailer. I thought it was cut quite oddly. I didn't find it a thrilling ride to watch. Maybe I need to watch it a couple more times. Sorry to be a party pooper, everybody. Anyway, I'm going to go home now, write my weekly pub quiz, crack opener, Coca-Cola. And I'll see you guys next week. Enjoy. This has been all over the place, this intro. Please enjoy my conversation with the lovely, gorgeous, wonderful and hilarious Tom Burgess.
It seems that I'm some kind of a galactic yo-yo.
Do you want to put the mic closer to your mouth, Tom? I like a very poppy, yes. Horrible sound.
Oh, really? Great. Well, it can be poppy and horrible. Gorgeous. Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled pepper and popped a mic and, yeah. Okay, this is great.
Have you ever had a peck of pickled pepper?
I actually never have. Never had one. Never picked one.
I don't like pickled things. I have a strong aversion to vinegar things, which makes me come across as a fussy eater. But I'm not.
Because there's vinegar in it. You can't have ketchup. This is sad.
I'm so anti-ketchup.
Oh, I love ketchup.
I knew it was a phobia and not just a dislike when I was in the supermarket one time, and I was in the aisle that has all of the pickle things, the vinegar things, the sauerkraut, everything like that. And I looked at all those things and I thought, would I rather eat this stuff or be tortured at Guantanamo. And I, you'll be pleased to know, I resolved that I would rather eat the vinegar stuff.
But however, with a heavy heart.
The fact that I even considered the other option
speaks
to the fact that it's probably more than a dislike.
Yeah, that's fair. Vinegar's an interesting phobia, though. I've just got wasps. It's dull.
Wasps?
Yeah.
Is that a phobia?
Well,
everybody's scared of wasps.
The level
they?
Of agitation makes okay, it feel sure. like a phobia. Like, I freeze and become just non-functional for a few minutes until they've gone.
This is like my pal who's frightened of crocodiles, which is...
Yeah, no, that's fair.
Everyone goes, oh, yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah. You can't look at a photograph of one. One time, I was in the... I used to live with him, and I was just working from home in the flat, and he was on the toilet, and I heard him scream. And I said, are you okay, Andrew? Is everything all right? What's the matter? And he goes, sorry, I just saw a crocodile on Twitter. yeah, so it's like it's rational, but it isn't at the same
yeah,
time.
Yeah, like I feel like that's sort of, there's a halfway house there. Like, it's not like someone's saying they've got a fear of warfare. Like, that's just, like, imagine that. That'd be terrible.
For sure. Or a fear of Lawrence Fox.
Yeah, I mean
makes total sense.
I'm so scared of that.
I saw him in the flesh the other day.
No, what was he doing?
He was
going through Billy Piper's bins.
No, but it was similarly predictable. I was at the Free Palestine March, and he was there, but he was standing on the side of the road, fraternizing with the police. very, very Lawrence Fox behaviour. I'm here with Tom Burgess. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Tom has kindly allowed me to come to his home to record the podcast.
Yes.
Because he lives in Manchester and I don't live in Manchester. So yes. And I felt it was wrong to invite a strange man to my parents' home.
Yes. And I am very strange. I sent a lot of threats.
You know, you must be DBS checked.
I am actually.
You
work
in children's television.
Yes, so I have full DBS check, but that means I'm qualified to work with children, but not necessarily the parents. So that's the problem.
Fine,
you see,
fine, I see.
Parents actually a no go for me. I'm not allowed. Yeah.
Who are you? What's your backstory?
I am a comedian, arguably. There's one audience in Matlock who thinks I'm not. They were angry.
Right, we were quite clear about that.
They didn't know why I was there. To be fair. I was the second act on.
Yeah.
Once the MC and the first act had been on, neither did I. So it's fair enough, I think. But I have mainly, for the last few years, been doing a character comedy act called Peter Fleming, mm-hmm. who is an entirely fictitious BBC children's TV pioneer. Having done a few shows at Edinburgh about his own work at the BBC, all of which has been wiped, presumably by mistake.
Okay.
And a show to celebrate
Marco Polo.
Yeah, Marco Polo. Okay, he did that one himself. Actually, he got rid of that himself. He got the magnet, okay. Put it over the tape, whoosh, gone. But last year, I spent basically my entire comedy year was spent working on and performing the show Peter Fleming Meets Doctor Who, which is an hour-long comedy show in which Peter recounts the various encounters he had over basically the classic run of Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. So I think the first regeneration, that was his fault, accidentally pushed William Hartnell down the stairs, put him out of action.
I see. So you're sort of kind of retroactively putting Peter Fleming into the history of Doctor Who.
Yes, exactly that. So the clip of Blue Peter that I think you get on the Invisible Enemy DVD, I'm assuming the Blu-ray as well, where K-9 meets Shep.
Yep.
In the Peter Fleming universe, Shep in that clip is Peter Fleming disguised as Shep.
Okay.
I wish I could say it makes more sense in context.
Peter Fleming universe, okay. Yeah. Why Peter Fleming?
So I
can't have been the only person who, when I first encountered your work, assumed you were just a man called Peter Fleming.
Yeah, I've had requests.
It's a normal. It's a normal name.
It is, and I've had
it's
requests
not,
from.
You know, yeah. So it's not Frank Sidebottom, where you go,
no,
okay,
it's not.
It's a bit wacky.
It's
on my stage name, Molly Martian, which is like no one's called Martian.
No, Peter Fleming is a believable name, and I think I realised a couple of years into the act, you know, when it was too late to change, I realised maybe this was an issue. The real thing that alerted me was the fact that it turns out John McEnroe's former doubles partner is called Peter Fleming. He's a US tennis pro.
When I googled you, I found this out myself.
Yeah. And he is... I am occasionally tagged on Twitter by people trying to contact the former tennis player, Peter Fleming, to tell him what great insight he's giving on the Wimbledon coverage. And I reply in character and they block me. And that's... It's really sad.
It's like that man who's called John Lewis.
Yeah,
and
it's the guy John Lewis.
Every year around the Christmas ad, he spends like 2 weeks replying to tweets.
And that is me. But I have had a comic got in touch once to ask if I wanted to do a double preview, and his message opened, "Hi, Peter." And the worst thing was, he has met me before. He knows I'm not called that.
Right, yeah.
But he's
since
forgotten.
Hi, Peter. So paint me a picture of Peter Fleming. How old is he supposed to be?
Impossibly old. Yeah. I didn't want to give him a specific age. In my head, he's probably in his 80s, but he's in his 80s forever.
Sure.
Yeah, because basically...
Do you bother with the physicality of a person in their 80s? Or not really?
Yeah, I frequently soil myself on stage, actually. And that was a pre-existing problem, so I built a character around it to try and... I'd get terrible nerves every time. I think I do find myself... I'm a natural sloucher, but I slouch a bit further to the point that it's nearly a crouch. I don't grey my own hair naturally. I put talk in it. So any time I move, I'm basically under a cloud on stage.
That's really great.
It adds a nice effect.
Yeah.
The crowd's like that. Apart from the sort of... There were a few gigs I did in sort of February and very early March 2020, when obviously it's... drifted from my hair into the mouths and lungs of the front two rows, and they all started coughing. And
That's not good.
Yeah, the audience got nervous, even though it was only me that was in the firing line. I was the only one facing them. I knew what it was because I've seen it happen before.
Did you just get talc on everything?
A lot of things, actually. Every single time.
That's why I couldn't be a character comic. The stuff they have to go through.
Well, I mean, I could buy a wig. I just refuse.
But it's clearly part of the bit that you're putting the talc on your hair.
Yeah, I think it's less of one now than it used to be. But yeah,
I know this guy, Joe, who does this character, Frankie Munro.
I love Frankie
Munro. Oh, do you know Frank? Right, yeah. So, and he just puts this like pseudocreme on his face to be Frankie Munro. And every show it gets in his eyes. Like, it's part of the act that it gets in his eyes. And I'm like, Joe, you're so funny. But I could never put myself through that.
Joe and I think, are basically we are the spectrum of smell on the character comedy circuit, really. You're either at the talc end or the pseudocreme end.
I mean, what about... have you met Rosa Garland?
I haven't met Rosa Garland.
So she does this character, Trash Salad.
That sounds more familiar.
Where she... I saw her do it once. And she essentially, spoiler alert for the Trash Salad show, reveals her breasts... and then squirts salad cream directly onto her breast. And I was on the same bill as her. So she had to like walk past me to get into the dressing room after she'd done her act. And honestly, the stench of the salad cream.
No.
I couldn't do it to myself. I mean, it was a riot. Her act is amazing.
Oh, God.
In her latest show, it ends with her urinating into a vase. It's just completely iconic.
Can I just say, that is stolen from Peter Fleming. I end the Doctor Who show pissing into the master tape of Power of the Daleks 3. That was my...
I don't do that.
I should have done that, though.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the master tape wasn't available. I did ask.
Yeah.
They said, no, we don't have it. And even if we did, we wouldn't lend it you for that.
I mean, I'm always saying we should be taping over that stuff. We don't need Kevin Stoney as Mavic Chen to exist.
No.
We should take a magnet to all of it.
No, we should really be desecrating as many of those tapes as possible.
Absolutely. When did your story with Doctor Who begin, Tom?
Significantly earlier than my story with Peter Fleming. I think Peter Fleming stems from me being a Doctor Who fan. Absolutely. So the Doctor Who show is basically his origin story, I think. It does go quite personal at the end where it goes quite meta. And how Doctor Who has basically inspired the creation of this character. But my Doctor Who story starts... It has a prologue when I'm 4, and then it starts properly when I'm 6. Much as people who run Doctor Who now, like Rusty Davis, and I think perhaps Stephen Moffat as well, some of their earliest memories are of the Hartnell era. Rusty Davis's earliest memory is Hartnell changing into Troughton.
Right.
My earliest memory is...
Which
does survive because of Blue Peter. You're welcome.
You were personally responsible.
Yeah, that's thanks to me. I mean, to be fair, it is also because of Blue Peter that Dalek's Master Plan 4 just is missing. They lent it there, it never came back.
Sure.
I think it's buried in a time capsule somewhere, but we can't prove this. but My earliest memory of Doctor Who, and I was not behind the sofa for this, I was crouched by it. I remember the exact angle where I was in the TV.
No one was behind the sofa, it's a mess.
No one. I was next to the sofa.
Who has their sofa not against the wall?
I know, it's weird.
That doesn't make any sense.
You'd have to dig, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. So I was crouched next to the sofa, watching Eric Roberts as the Master, shouting, "I always dress for the occasion." And that was really good. Thank you. Yeah, it's just burned in. But I think that might be my earliest memory at all, let alone of telly. But it's definitely the earliest telly memory I have.
This is like how my earliest memory is Darth Maul falling down the hole in Phantom Menace.
Wow. That's a great first memory
and
to have.
Splitting into two bits.
Your first memory is of the only bit of hope that trilogy had. Just slipping away down the tubes.
I loved it as a kid. We all did.
Oh, yeah. I loved it as a kid. I loved it as a kid. Although, actually, another early memory I have of telly from when it came out, I remember watching Lee Zomazimba, who was still on Newsround.
And he's a huge Doctor Who fan himself,
He is. But he was...
I tried to poach him for this podcast before. No luck yet.
You've got to get him. We need to know what Lizzo knows. Lizzo must have the dirt on everyone by now.
Yeah.
But he was at the premiere for Phantom Menace, and they did a live link from the Newsround studio to him and his opinion of it, that he said to all the kids who'd been getting so excited by all the advertising, "Oh, wow, episode one."
Then
it cuts to Lizzo doing a live link to the camera saying, "It was good, but it wasn't great." And I thought, oh, right. I think that was my first experience of the feeling that something is a 3-star film. I just remember a 3-star film.
Funnily enough, I mean, I think I've covered this on here before, but that, with you mentioning the TV movie, I think I kind of had, that was my first idea of this was good but not great. So my dad got me into Doctor Who, and he was very much like, you know, he'd introduce me to the classic series and he explained like, "Oh, there's this weird like McGann detour and no one's even sure if it counts, and it wasn't very good, and it was a bit of a hit and a miss." A bit of a swing and a miss. And he, before the Eccleston series started, was like preparing me for disappointment.
Yeah.
We were both excited, but he was like, "Look, like, it might be dreadful. And we need to be ready for that."
That's great. That's standard fandom. Just get ready for it to be bad. Yeah. That's great. Sets you up.
You saw Eric Roberts. I always dress for the occasion.
Yes, I always dress for the occasion. So
2 years later, at the age of six.
2 years later, I don't think I'd thought about Doctor Who in those intervening 2 years.
Okay. What were you thinking about mainly?
Power Rangers, even though I never watched it or owned any toys, but they were just all in the
Argos
catalogue.
Was it a sexual thing?
Well, I was five, so we can only assume
yes. Sure.
But I was... going about my business, being six, my uncle sadly passed away, and he was quite young. And he left behind this very cluttered house in Derbyshire, and we went to clear it out. And on the shelf was a double VHS of the Sontaran Experiment and Genesis of the Daleks.
Wow, okay.
And I remember seeing the words Doctor Who going, "Oh, Doctor Who," like that thing. So I obviously remembered from 2 years before. So I know one of my brothers recorded it. I think we must have rewatched it at some
point. Must have, surely.
So that memory was still alive there. And I think we put that on within that same week, watching that on the telly. And I remember being absolutely hooked by
the music of
it. Forgive me for
inquiring into your age. This
would have been in 1998.
Okay.
This happened. So yeah, my earliest memory.
2 years.
So yeah, my earliest memory is seeing the TV movie go out. I saw that go out live.
Okay.
And then after that is when I discovered Tom Baker.
Right.
What is great about that double VHS, and I've got the picture saved on my phone, is the inlay of that has loads of other cover photos available of different VHSs you can get. And I want to get every single one of them.
It's on the inside of the paper behind the plastic.
That's it, yes. Yeah. And I know.
Always kind of slightly obscure because they can never get it to be tight to the plastic.
Yeah, you can never get it quite there. And if you have to open it out fully to actually see all of it, or just take the sleeve out, which I sometimes did just to see it a little bit purer, just without that glass. You needed it. You needed it that way. Oh. If you're looking at that VHS artwork through the plastic, you're cutting the artwork with rat poison.
Sure.
It's basically what you're doing. It's awful stuff. Don't do it. Just enjoy as is.
I never thought I'd hear a hard drugs analogy about Doctor Who.
You can't disrespect Sid Who Sutton sleeps. And Andrew Skilleter and Colin Howard like that. It's not right.
Oh, it was so great, like, buying a new VHS tape. It's like, there's this Armando Iannucci bit where he talks about the only things that make a person truly happy. And one of the things he lists is unpackaging a newly bought CD.
Yeah. And watching other people fail.
And it's, yeah. And watching other people, yeah.
Yes, yes.
And, gosh, no one's ever seen that.
I love that show. Yeah, it's so good. Watch the Armando Iannucci shows, yeah, so dear
such
listener.
Such a formative influence on me. But yeah, it's so true. And like seeing all the liner notes and all the stuff. And like you say, seeing the...
Yes, I just looked at all those pictures and I wanted to get every single one. And I was fascinated by... I don't know how I found out there were multiple actors who've played the Doctor. Yeah. I think someone must have explained some things about this show to me. But the most vivid memories I have of those are a couple of cliffhangers. The Sontar experiment where Starr takes his helmet off and that sort of shriek the music does at the cliffhanger. Not the actual start of the title music, but the incidental music does this sort of electronic, like, glissando upwards. Yeah. And I remember the freeze frame end of Genesis Part 2, where Sarah falls from the gantry. So freeze frame works. Top marks, David Maloney. Thank you. Well done. And so I think that stuff just lit my imagination on fire. And I immediately wanted to try and get hold of as many as I could. Didn't know how, because it turned out loads of them actually were already deleted because of the branding upheaval in the wake of the TV movie. So sure. Loads of things that were in those, you know, that was in that sort of liner note
right,
section.
Okay.
A lot of them were already gone. But I was very lucky for two reasons. Firstly, I lived about 15 minutes drive from Longleat when the exhibition was still open.
Oh, cool.
Which had lots of like secondhand VHSs in there. And there was also a shop in Froome in Somerset where I grew up, a shop called Cheap Street, which has a little stream running down the middle because it's the tweeest place in the world. And in the middle of that street was a shop called the Video Crypt, which was
okay.
A huge secondhand video shop. It was an offshoot of Raves from the Grave down the road that did CDs.
Right.
And it eventually got superseded by Vinyl Heaven.
Raves from the Grave.
Raves from the Grave.
That's so cool.
Go and shop at Raves from the Grave. Wow. It's still there. It exists. But I found loads of, especially John Pertwee's,
yes,
in the Video Crypt, and I think that's probably why he remains my favourite Doctor. I watched so much of his as a kid.
They were repeating him on UK Gold all the time.
Yes, actually, UK Gold is another one. I was literally just thinking about that today because we are recording this the day after it's been announced that the first two episodes of Shooty Gatwa's first season will be
simultaneously.
Yes.
Spunked out by the Disney machine.
I think that's the technical term. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I was reflecting on that as we were all thinking, oh, but we love this experience of all watching together. And when you're a Wilderness Years fan, I suddenly realized actually I didn't have that experience until 2005 properly. Mm. Up until then, you know, I was consuming Doctor Who on demand. I went down to the Video Crypt. I demanded the Green Death. I got the Green Death.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
And so...
Ashton Market.
Yeah.
That had a video shop. Is that where you went? Get some of them, yeah. Well, sometimes Smith's. W.H. Smith.
Oh, yeah. Actually, yeah. I think I went there for some of the new ones. I got... Oh, what was it? There were a couple of VHS box sets that were exclusive to W.H. Smith's, and I got the Time Lord collection.
Oh, love it.
And the Davros collection.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And for some reason, I gave the Davros collection to a charity shop, even though I begged my parents for that because we found one copy in one W.H. Smith.
Why did you give it away?
I have no idea. I don't know. Basically, I think I must,
like that made me
I must
so
have
sad.
Had a breakdown. It's the only possible reason.
It's like when my dad, when he was a boy, and he'll never live this down. He told me he'd done it once when I was a child, and I was like, Dad, how could you do something like that? When he was at school, he swapped his FX7 action figure for a rubber skeleton. Do you know FX7?
I don't. So, but I can tell from your tone that it's not a good swap.
It looks a bit like a Dalek, actually. So you know, in Star Wars, in the Empire Strikes Back, when Luke is injured and he's in the back to town.
Oh, like the medical droid.
There's a medical droid, the blue one called 2-1-B, which is actually the only action figure that my father kept. when he sold all of his Star Wars figures to pay for the baby he'd had, this baby.
Oh, fuck. God, you ruined his life. Well, I'm sorry.
I don't know. It had a part to play.
Those...
The FX-7 droid is the one that is... that stands next to the Bacta tank. There's like a bit like a Dalek. It's got loads of little medical attachments.
Yes, okay,
that's
yes.
That's FX-7.
Oh.
Swapped it for a rubber skeleton, Tom. Would you believe it?
That's really bad.
Really bad.
Rubber skeleton's not remotely niche.
No, not at
You're
all.
You're not going to get any pennies for that.
Sorry. Yes, you were buying all the VHS tapes.
Can I just say, I also regret getting rid of my movable Jabba the Hutt, where you could swivel the head and it swiveled the tail as well.
Yeah. So good.
Why did I get rid of that?
I had a special Jabba the Hutt that was a part of a two-pack with a Han Solo. And it's actually quite rare. Mm. You got it. I got it in like 99, 2000. And it was made in conjunction with the 97 special edition of Star Wars.
That scene that got
from
made.
The deleted scene.
We had the same thing.
Did you have the same thing?
Yeah, I had that Han Solo as well. Yeah, I had too many Han Solos.
I had him sure, in carbonite as well. It's a slightly more off-white colour than the regular Han Solo toy.
Yes. You know what? I think I actually remember seeing that in something like the Argos catalogue, thinking, oh, but that looks different.
Slightly off.
This one's gone off a bit. It's terrible.
Sometimes people say to me, Molly, do you think you've got autism? And I go, how dare you?
I'm on a waiting list, so...
Okay.
This became increasingly a joke in the Peter Fleming Doctor Who show, because I think I'm trying to remember exactly how it came up. I think it was because there's a photo of me at a wedding when I'm about 8 years old,
right,
where I'm dressed not as him but with a very Colin Baker aesthetic,
sure,
very colourful waistcoat. And I held this photo up, and I'm actually standing very awkwardly and look quite uncomfortable in the photo.
Yeah.
And then, I can't remember exactly what I ended up saying, but as I said to the audience, I mean, it seems very likely.
Yeah.
we've seen the last hour, haven't we? I think as I said to in the show as it went on, if you're the parent of a seven-year-old and your child's favourite thing to read at bedtime is Doctor Who, the Book of Lists, maybe that's something worth looking into, because that was definitely aimed at adults as well. There was nothing for kids in that period of the wilderness years. They'd given up.
Yeah, but if your child's favourite thing to read is the Star Wars action figure guide,
yeah,
has just loads of photographs of action figures and facts about them and when they were released and kind of information about manufacture,
general product codes, stuff like that. Yeah.
Or if you are a girl at university and you snog a person in a nightclub and you go home with them. And on their wall are handwritten lists of every Doctor Who story with production codes, and then you leave that house and you never go back. Oh. That story was not from the point of view of me. It was a story about me.
That's heartbreaking. Yeah.
Where were we?
I mean, mind you, in Queer as Folk, the opposite happens where someone...
That's true.
You're the anti-Vince.
Yeah. So it's 2005. Doctor Who's back on air.
Yes. And it was so exciting. I mean, I remember... not just it coming back, but I remember the build-up to it from my point of view, because there were very few ways to really engage in the world of Doctor Who as a kid in that sort of latter part of the wilderness
years,
when people had sort of... they were starting to give up hope, I think, that it was ever going to come back. It felt quite pessimistic. And my first contact with fandom really was after... So 98, 99, I'm buying lots of VHS. There's also loads of stuff on TV because Blue Peter features Doctor Who for about 10 minutes in a 1999 episode. BBC Two has its Doctor Who night, which I recorded off TV as it went out and watched over and over again. There's that repeat season that happened. So I was taking loads of it in. But my first contact with fandom was buying my first ever copy of Doctor Who magazine, which would have been about January 2000. And the letters page was just full of people saying why the Doctor Who night that I loved was actually a load of crap. And everything they hated about it. 10 monsters is hardly a carnival.
That's Doctor Who fans for you then.
But I mean, I realise that now. Now I just embrace it. I hate Doctor Who as well. It's terrible. Don't watch it. It's a waste of time. Get a life. But I think it was really hard to engage with it as a community, or that's what I found anyway. So for me, being a fan was always quite an individualistic thing. You would just be picking up your VHS as doing your own little archaeological expedition. And you would be going on to, say, the BBC website. So I did that a lot. And that is how
Which
I came
was a treasure trove.
Yes, it was a treasure trove. I loved
thank
all the
you,
photo
James
galleries.
Goss.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, James Goss. Thank you. Thank you, sir.
No, James Goss would like that too much. Don't do that.
You're a great man, James Goss. Follow me on Twitter, please, James Goss.
Does James Goss not follow you on Twitter?
I think he does, actually.
Oh, okay.
I'm worried he might have no idea who I am.
Get your act together, Jim.
For God's sake. Yes, Jim. Can I call you? Yeah, Jim. This is a weird way to introduce yourself to someone.
You've been going on the Doctor Who website. You've been sniffing around.
One day I came home from school and I still remember the GIF that was looping around saying, Doctor Who is coming back. It will be on BBC One on Saturday nights 2005. It's being written by Rossi Davies. All of these bits of information. So it said something like, no, you're not dreaming. Sit down, have a biscuit. It's a good day. Something like that. And that was then just the 18-month build-up of just buying Doctor Who magazine every month. That was still the digest information I had. I remember the new logo being unveiled in 2004.
The taxi logo.
The taxi logo. I love a taxi logo. If I saw a taxi coming and it had just that Doctor Who logo on it, I'd get in.
You'd get in no matter where the guy was driving.
Yeah, and if it had the...
You'd get in his boot.
And if it had the Matt Smith one with the insignia, I'd think about it.
Yeah, okay.
I wouldn't say yes immediately,
what
but
about
I'd probably still get
the
on.
The Chibnall era...
I would get in that if it was accompanied by the opening titles and that version of the theme tune.
Sure.
I love that.
Yeah, that's good.
Love that. I love the look of that series.
Yeah. What about if it had the diamond? The new
100%,
diamond logo.
Getting the new diamond logo. The one I would probably leap into fastest is the diamond logo with all the sort of red and orange colouring of the VHS
of the range. Yeah. Which one would you not get in? McCoy.
I would consider McCoy. I think I'd reject the Troughton logo.
It's not really even a logo.
It's like a knockoff.
Yeah, it's not even a logo, really.
No, you'd get that in the market in Lithuania.
I don't love the Davison Baker look. No. It's a bit trying too hard to be Star Wars, isn't it?
It is.
It's like
I've never thought of it that way.
The way it's stacked like that, and the way it's like all spacey,
letters all joining up as well.
It's a little bit.
I'd never thought of that
and
before.
And Doctor Who's
it's
very rarely deferential to other things. It's more often, it feels like it's inspired by other things. And
yeah,
that feels
it's
more
a,
kind
it's
of
a little
like
bit reactive.
Yes, I would agree. Reactive is the word. Mm. Do you remember? And I've asked, you'll know Chris Johnson, right?
Oh, yes.
I've asked Chris Johnson this.
I once gave him a pie on set that he then sadly shoved his own face in.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's very CBBC.
There's a lot of people who've done that, so he won't remember that either.
Yeah, okay.
But it was in May 2015, so... Yeah.
Sure.
That'll if he's listening, that'll help him.
But I asked him this, and he didn't remember, but maybe you will. Or maybe it's Mandela Effect, and I have made this up. I remember it would have been about 2002 or 3.
Mm-hmm.
Probably 2. Because there was no sign of Doctor Who coming back yet.
Mm-hmm.
And other children didn't know about Doctor Who. And on children's BBC, there were idents that were little green blobs that would sort of morph into other things.
Yes, okay.
And sometimes it would become a little Dalek.
Oh, so I thought you were going to talk about a different CBBC ident, because there was definitely someone, there were people at CBBC who were definitely into Doctor Who and were making that image come alive. So I'm not at all surprised there was a little green blob that turned into a Dalek. I've not seen that, but I have seen the idents before then, which were from the late 90s, early noughties, that was all sort of a yellow and black motif, sort of cartoony figures.
Sure.
And there was one...
Oh, I think I've seen these on the internet.
Yeah, and this is just on one of the BBC Two ones, and it's... it is a black vortex, and it's the CBBC jingle that they were using, but done in a Doctor Who style.
Yes.
No TARDIS, though. No Daleks.
But you don't remember the little green blob?
I don't remember the little green blobs. We've just missed each other.
I don't think I made it up. Because I remember thinking...
I don't think you
made
it up. I think it's believable.
This is very neurodivergent of me. I remember, you know, I'd have been 7, you know, and I remember pointing at the screen and being like, oh my God, it's Doctor Who. And then thinking, I wonder why they've done that. And thinking, well... You know, a Dalek's a... I mean, I wouldn't have thought of it with this vocabulary, but a Dalek's a well-known piece of iconography, and then thinking, but not among people my age, and that's who CBBC. Yeah, and I went through this whole thought process.
But
about
I'm not
it.
The target audience. It's weird. We all develop that kind of self-loathing about it. We make ourselves into outsiders all the time.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, okay, I'm going to accept that it happened.
It did happen.
It did happen.
You're not wrong.
So when Dr. Who comes back on, you are what, in your late teens, mid-teens?
Early teens. So I'm 13 when it comes 13. Back. 13. I turn 14 between Parting of the Ways and Christmas Invasion. And if we want to get more precise, between Parting of the Ways and the Children in Need scene.
I love that Children in Need scene. It's so great, good. Isn't it?
And that was actually a really nice experience, that whole year of it coming back, because I was, like, enough kids were aware of Doctor Who in the early noughties to know it was like a sad thing for geeks.
Sure.
So enough people knew about it for me to get teased about it quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, that had been following me around for a few years when it actually came back. And I still remember, and this is why I won't hear a word against this story and think it's hugely underrated. The Monday after Aliens of London went out, but before World War III went out, loads of people who had been making fun of me for liking Doctor Who all came back to me in the playground really annoyed that they were having to wait a week to find out what happened next.
Yes.
And that was when I thought, oh,
Doctor Who's cool now.
Yeah, I've
won. And all the other kids were coming up to you and they were going, God, you were right, Tom. That Doctor Who, it's sticking it to the Blair regime.
Yes, they could see.
It's got really vital, urgent things to say about Iraq. Is that what they were saying to you?
No, they just started farting at me.
But that's the beauty of Doctor Who, isn't it? It does like, get you a man who can do both, right? Cool. So, when do you become a comedian? What's your history of performing? And to what extent? Because, you know, actors like David Tennant and Peter Capaldi have spoken about being inspired by Doctor Who to become performers. Do you feel the same is true? What's your story with becoming a stand-up?
It definitely links into creativity. I think wanting to perform, wanting to make people laugh, comes from other TV shows, but from about the same sort of era as the Doctor Who I was watching. I think Not the 9 o'clock News probably had a huge impact on me as a kid, and probably also the young ones. Another early TV memory of mine is one of my brothers putting on the young ones on VHS, my dad walking in, pointing at it, and saying, "That is not suitable!" And then we'll have to leave the room. Not that bad. It's just Rick Mayall. What's the problem? He's fine.
Oh, my dad was a bit of a Victorian father too.
Did he own a workhouse as well?
One thing I remember is being about 15 and my dad turning off. Have you seen the music video to Danger High Voltage? You know that song?
Yeah, I know the song.
Have you seen the music
video? But I don't know the video.
The music video, it's quite tame. It features a man and a woman with light bulbs on their breasts and genitals.
That's not suitable, Molly.
But they're fully clothed.
That is not suitable.
and the light bulbs flash in time to the music, right? Danger, danger, high voltage, when we touch, when we kiss.
Well, that's teaching you about rhythm. That's actually very valuable.
Exactly. And I remember my dad turning it off and me going, "What's wrong? Do you like that song?" And he was like, it's not appropriate. It's not appropriate. And I'm thinking, Dad, I've got a girlfriend. Like, what are you doing? But yes, the young ones...
Yes,
not the 9 o'clock news.
Watching those things,
I think, distracting you. Sorry.
No, that's fine. I mean, I'm easily distractible. Again, if it's not autism, it's ADHD. We don't know. It's gonna be. There's gotta be something.
Maybe it's leprosy.
But yes, it could be. It could be. I love the experience of laughing, and I wanted to make other people laugh as well. And some of that is maybe from brothers as well, because there are home movies that exist from the Burgess household, and we are all basically making sketch comedy together, but as a 4-year-old, a 9-year-old, and a 13-year-old.
Love that.
It's actually, the ones that I'm not in are surprisingly good, actually.
Okay.
I kind of...
Are you the youngest brother?
Or? Yeah, okay. Hence everything. Sure. Yeah, I'm a bit of a wild card in those because I don't really understand structure yet. But when...
Got you. Okay.
Yeah, but when I'm not present, the sketches themselves actually stand up pretty well.
Love it.
Yeah, yeah. So I think I grew up in a household that was quite comedy literate, and I think that definitely played a role. So wanting to be a comedian, I mean, you could say I got into comedy when I was that age. Mm. I think that was when I started performing, because that just became part of every conversation. I would chuck quotes in, devoid of context, because I didn't understand why they were funny yet. Yeah. I just knew that there was a laugh, so it's just inherently funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think, when did I actually start gigging properly? That would have been in the 2010s. I met Sam Nicaresti at university. We started doing sketch comedy together, and we were in an atrociously named act called Stapleface once.
Right.
Sam came up with a name. Their fault, not mine. Okay. I'm taking no responsibility. Sure. And then we became the innocuously named Sam and Tom. Equally disappointing Google results, though. I mean, it's just a shame. I mean, they're less harrowing than Stapleface, and on YouTube, but
Stapleface is good.
Yeah, but it turned out
it's better than Sam and Tom.
But it turned out there was a trend.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, no. And we wanted no part
Shut
of it.
Up. There was a trend.
There was. But I don't know why. Why That's were people horrible. Doing this to themselves?
Well, I mean, people did all sorts on the internet in that era, didn't they?
They did. They
Remember
did.
Remember the man who chopped his knob off with a plastic bag?
Online? Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
A guy all did right. it down the road the other day as well. Horrible. So we began gigging around, did a few Edinburgh runs together, and what did we do? So I don't
forgive me. I'm diabetic.
Yeah, no, and
I started injecting myself.
No, this is
unannounced,
fine.
And Tom is now distracted.
I'm just pausing because I just think is the polite thing to carry on talking while you apply the EpiPen or just to pause? Cause
well,
it's
for
more
one,
convenient.
It's not an EpiPen. It's an insulin pen. And
that's good because
the polite
less,
thing
that's less
is
urgent, presumably.
To do whatever you want to do.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that looks amazing. Why have you got tentacles coming out? It's mad. I'm just trying to think of my comedy career now. God, it's in tatters. I don't know what I have.
When does Tom Burgess become Peter Fleming?
Every night at 8 o'clock.
Stop that.
When does Tom Burgess become Peter Fleming? Well, I think Tom Burgess stops being Tom Burgess every time he goes on stage, pretty much. I have performed stand-up as me about twice.
Oh, really?
I
quite
did not
rarely.
Enjoy it
so
at
when
all.
You were doing the sketch stuff with Sam, it was all characters.
Yes, I loved being just characters. Or if we were being Sam and Tom, it was like we were two characters.
Versions
Sam
of
and
Sam
Tom.
And Tom.
Yes.
So were you? Was there a straight man and a wacky guy? Or
I think. I was probably straighter, I would say, but I think we both had different bits that meant we became the wacky one.
Sure.
Especially the show where we swap bodies, but you know, that was
wow,
that was,
okay.
You just take it as read.
Cool.
I got to be wacky for a bit.
That
it
sounds
was great.
Funny.
It was. Yeah. yeah, I thought I had something to add to it, but I didn't. Sorry.
That's okay.
On current evidence, yeah, I was the straight man. Absolutely. So
in all senses of the word.
So I found it a lot easier being Tom in a double act with someone else to fall back on. Or being someone else completely different,
right.
Which I think is where Peter came from. Although originally Peter just arose as a framing device for some other stuff.
Because
when we were in Stapleface and also in Sam and Tom, I wrote things that became Peter Fleming sketches, but originally they were just sketches that randomly popped up in Stapleface shows. Like there was a Peter Fleming created an ad campaign for Matey Bubble Bath starring characters called the Salty Sailors.
Okay, sure.
Who just drink the Matey.
Right. okay.
And mention every few seconds that they're in the Navy. Okay. And also occasionally they drink brine because
sure.
they just love brine because it's what you do in the Navy.
And you've got a DBS check.
It's somewhere here. I was writing these sketches that suddenly turn up, and I would always have them backed with music from the BBC Radiophonic Workshop.
Right.
Like, they were funny, but no one was really sure why. They didn't make sense. You felt like you were very much stepping into a very specific world every time those things came on. There was one also called Helping Hands that was literally just me and Sam walking on the spot, hitting doorbells in time to a Delia Derbyshire track called Door to Door. And then the door would open, someone would say, hello, we'd offer some sort of service. And they'd say, no, thank you, everything's fine. Great, have a nice day, goodbye. Door would shut, track plays again.
Stupid.
And it's like 30 seconds long and we just keep marching, but marching more and more angrily because no one wants our help.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Until we're just screeching at them. And it, there was no way of making these things fit into wider shows. And I suddenly realized maybe they needed an actual frame device. So I was going to film some of them and do it as a documentary, because one of the some of the VHSs that I got as a Young Doctor Who fan were the years tapes, like Hartnell years, Troughton years.
Oh, yeah.
Cybermen the early years was a big one as well. So I
Is that David Banks on that?
He's not on that. Who have they got? They've got Roy Skelton.
Okay.
They've got...
Zippy himself.
Zippy himself. And he does say goodbye in character as Zippy.
Goes, does
he? Goodbye from Zippy and goodbye from George.
That's so good.
It's beautiful. And I'd never see... I saw that before I saw any rainbow.
Classic.
Oh, God. I've just imagined a cross between Rainbow and Rambo. That would be amazing. Rainbow First Blood. That's what people want.
A comedian's brain never stops working.
It never does.
So
never starts. No, but seriously, I am trying very hard.
Is this your Peter Fleming voice?
No, this is my Peter Fleming voice.
Okay.
Hello, everybody. I don't know why Matlock didn't like it. I basically sounded like one of them.
It's very high pitched compared to your real voice.
He becomes hysterical, and I think it's a state of nerves. And normally, I also speed up the rate of talking as Peter, and that was also, it was partly due to nerves and partly due to the fact that in 2016, Sam and I were splitting a bill, and I had about half an hour's worth of material, but only 25 minutes, and I'm not a very good editor, so I just said it quicker. And I've never been able to stop doing it since, unfortunately, even when I've had the right amount of material, so suddenly I underrun. It's an absolute catastrophe. Right, Peter, get out. Sorry, Tommy, get back in your box. No! Sorry about that.
But you said what I hear a lot of character comedians say, which is that they feel more comfortable in character. However, it seems like there's some of Tom in Peter.
There is, I think. I mean, one thing I have said to people is that I think Peter is more like me than I am in a lot of ways. I feel almost like there is a bit of me that can be articulated more clearly through Peter Fleming than I can.
Okay.
And I'm more comfortable on stage when I'm being Peter Fleming, which means I can actually do the stuff that comedians do and actually engage with audiences. When I'm there as me, I have no idea what to do.
So would a good phrase maybe be alter ego?
Oh, I think it just might.
Do you think something there's like something you're channeling?
Yes, I mean, let's get pretentious about it. I am channeling him.
Yeah.
From beyond the grave. He's been dead for decades. Yeah. Every gig is actually a seance.
Yeah.
I'm feeding off the energy of the audience in the room. It's like Quatermass or Ghost Watch or something.
And are there situations where you feel like you might want to use Peter in your personal life?
Definitely, yes. Yeah? Much, much easier. Dating became a lot easier once I was Peter Fleming. Right.
I imagine you're joking, but I was sort of being serious.
No, the Hinge deal breaker was just 75 plus. And that was it.
Excellent.
I think there are some ways where if I'm trying to write something, at least if I can actually assume that voice, that becomes easier.
Yeah.
But that's probably true of anyone who's writing as them as well. Like they don't necessarily write in their own voice. They're just good at swapping between them. Well, that's how I imagine it to be. I mean, everyone's creative process is so different.
For me, I'm kind of the opposite of you as a performer. I don't like doing characters and I don't like, you know, acting and being something I'm not because I guess I find it's more pressure because it's easier to make a mistake, right? You can fall out of character or it's more obvious when your act has gone wrong.
Yes,
I suppose.
Yeah.
I know that sounds like a really basic thing, but that makes it harder for me to kind of really feel in that thing.
No, I get that. It's harder to fix, I think, if you feel like the character itself isn't working. It's hard to break out of that. There have been gigs, I hate to say it, but there have been gigs other than that one time in Matlock where Peter Fleming hasn't gone down that well. And I made the mistake of asking a man in the front row who had his arms crossed and was scowling, hello, do you hate this? And he immediately said, yes. There was no way to recover from
you
that.
It's like if your character, I suppose it helps the longer you've been doing a character. But
yeah, I've got more comfortable with acknowledging it not working, but still keeping the voice.
Yeah.
So I think I suppose there's a difference between breaking the character altogether and breaking away from the script. So I can be Peter Fleming, the TV producer, when it's going well.
Mm.
And if it's going badly, I become Peter Fleming, the failing comic.
Sure, yeah. And there's a malleability to it.
Yeah, you suddenly are engaging. And in a way, it's funnier being the failing comic because you are actually engaging with the room, which in the end is what the audience wants.
Like, yeah.
The jokes are all very well, but ultimately the audience the wants to feel like they're
the,
right
is
there.
In the interaction,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose I'm going to say something incredibly wanky, which kind of all stand-up comedians say. But for me, you know, there is to an extent Molly Marsh, the person you're talking to now,
mm-hmm.
and Molly Marsh and the comedian.
Yeah, no.
And she is me, but it's not like it's a conscious choice that I'm going, okay, I'm Molly Marsh now.
Yes, yeah.
It's, you know, it's something different, but because I know her so well, because she kind of is me, there's a malleability there where if the act isn't going well, I can kind of code switch into something a slightly different side of me or a slightly different type of performance.
Yes, and that can sometimes save a gig if you just know you have to switch
just
into
pivot.
That mode.
And the question I asked you about being Peter in your personal life to get more confident, I've found I've been performing ever since I was a kid, and I've not been doing comedy for as long. You know, it's maybe been 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, it was like performance poetry that I was doing.
Right.
So I kind of came at it through that angle. And so I'm like fairly new to it, I suppose. And I found that sometimes, because I found these ways to, I'm quite a high status comic, they call it, don't they? Mm. I found these ways of kind of putting the audience down to kind of, if the act isn't going well, or if I want to get a laugh, I can kind of insult somebody, right?
Yes. That's what high status comic, I thought it just meant you went to Oxbridge.
No,
I've had this all wrong.
And stop it. And I found that sometimes in my personal life I've got myself into hot water because I'm feeling a little insecure or nervous in a social situation, and I unconsciously put my stand-up comedy brain on and I suddenly become a rude person.
But that's do I ever do that? I think
the incident I'm thinking of is I was at a pub and I got talking to some strangers, as you sometimes do at a pub. And it was this couple who were going to get married, right? They were engaged. And the woman was showing me her ring and everything. And I asked her fiancé when he thought he was going to get cold feet, whether he thought it would be soon or the night before the wedding. Which, if I'd been on stage, would have been absolutely fine.
That can work, absolutely.
And it could have gone, because everyone understands the relationship of this is a comedian. Comedians are sometimes rude to the audience, and that's part of the transaction. When you're just like a girl in a pub talking to, so this woman looked at me and she goes, "What do you mean by that?" And then I end up having a shouting match with this woman. And that's kind of the worst example. But
you never want that at a gig. You never want the audience just pausing and then as one saying, "What do you mean by
that?" Well, this wasn't a gig.
I'm just saying it would be even worse if it wasn't a gig.
It would be even worse.
The entire audience just as one, the exact same rhythm. What do you mean by that?
There's something Doctor Who about that, isn't there? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which we've not talked about Doctor Who for about 15 minutes now.
Oh, I mean,
that's okay.
Is it worth it? I don't. Do people still watch that show?
So you made a Peter Fleming Doctor Who
just
show.
Just remember, millions. Sorry, yes. Around the world.
Millions around the world.
At the same time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And more than have been.
Yeah, which is nice. Which is nice.
So you've made the Peter Fleming Doctor Who show.
Yes.
Obviously, with his history as a BBC employee. that's not the right word. I'm going to start that bit again. So you've made the Peter Fleming Doctor Who show. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's like a clear link there with the character and his work for the BBC and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Was it tempting to go to Doctor Who from the start and you had to hold back, or was it just like an weirdly obvious second route? Or
it didn't occur to me to do it straight away. I think when I was first coming up with the character, it was partly to find a home for these sketches that I'd already written that were not Doctor Who based anyway. And I think I like the idea that it was part of that world, but not specifically making jokes about Doctor Who. I think because I didn't want people to think that you had to be in the know to enjoy it.
Sure.
I wanted it ideally to be people coming in because they got the character and sort of got where he was coming from. So it was more a vibe than any specific knowledge that you needed. So I wanted it to be something that could just stand up in its own world. The problem was people would come to it and think that there were in jokes that they were missing when actually they weren't. So I remember the debut run I did in Edinburgh, I was talking about Salty Sailors and the Bicycle Family and Professor Zany's Mad Laboratory. And there were these two people who were sort of looking at each other, sort of getting ready to leave, like people do in Edinburgh shows. And I just sort of cut off and say,
I'm so sorry, it's just, you two look like you want to leave, and I want to make it easier for you if you do. Do you want to go and find something you enjoy more? And they went,
and one of them said, I was born in 2001, I don't get the references. and I said,
wait, do you think I'm real? Is that what the... I'm a young man.
Yeah.
This is baby powder. It's carcinogenic. It's not age. Don't worry.
It's tricky though, isn't it? It must be because you don't want to, you know, you're making this show with a love of Doctor Who, so you don't want it to be like rudimentary, but also you don't want it to be impenetrable to
audiences. Yeah, it's a tightrope that you walk, but I think you can still. I think it just comes from thinking about what is funny about this thing, and if it is, you have to know this and this, then that can be quite difficult. But if the joke is the specificity itself, that you have to have an extremely intricate knowledge of something to actually get it, then I suppose it's how you phrase it and how much you build up the level of detail. Definitely. About something, maybe the audience will be able to laugh at it one way or the other. Actually, what I did find, especially towards the end of the run, is that you would be able to identify pockets on stage of diehard fans and people who'd come to see a comedy show.
Yeah.
And those audiences would laugh at different speeds, because some people would laugh when... I think that I used it quite early on to as a sort of way of measuring the room and where the different pockets of the audience were. I talked about Peter Fleming trying to get revenge on Doctor Who for getting a commission that he wanted that Saturday tea time slot.
Okay.
So he went scribbling on the paperwork because they had been allocated TC1 in TV Centre, and I scribbled and gave them Limegrove Studio D. And then the table, who've obviously come because of the Doctor Who show, laugh. And then the audience doesn't. I say,
yes, sorry, I should say, this table here are the fact checkers. If they laugh, it's because it's true.
And then suddenly the whole room is together. And then the side of the room who don't know Doctor Who now notice whenever those people laugh, and that becomes part of the joke. So you're immediately feeding this feedback loop of laughter within the audience. And then the Doctor Who fans know they've laughed early, and the audience know, and that makes them laugh again. So
it's kind of this complex...
I mean, any comedy gig, you are basically trying to... It's like keeping a fire going.
Just
putting more kindling on, and that is your job, and that's how you make it work. And that was how I was able to make a niche show work.
This sounds like a very specific kind of fire where you're going, okay, I'm going to...
Yeah, I think that's true. But I suppose
titillate the fronds.
Yes, you're I'm titillating the fronds. Yeah. That's all I was doing, really. Any comedy gig is titillating the fronds.
Yeah.
I mean, this is using a very specific tool to do it, but I don't think it's actually...
I don't want to know about your specific tool, Tom. That's not what this podcast is about.
I'm just trying to tell you about how I titillate the fronds. What's the problem?
No, that sounds like something that sounds more complicated than it is, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the most basic things that I think comedians do really well. And, you know, you're reading a room, you're playing an audience off against each other, you pick up what is affecting the atmosphere yeah. here. The fact that it happens to be about knowledge of Doctor Who rather yeah, than yeah, yeah. whether someone gets a bit of observational comedy or not.
Yeah, you know, or you know,
it's you use anything, and
I do a lot of queer nights, and instantly right, yes. you go, okay, who are my queers in the room?
Mm-hmm.
Who am I? Because there's some material I do that it, you know, I've done rooms that are like entirely straight people, and they just don't really get it. Yeah. Which you know is maybe the fault of the material in a way. It's like I'm not kind of. Giving enough context, or I'm not reading my room properly. But yeah, you're going, okay, where's my queer people, and how, and where actually am I, like, am I non-queer people, and how can I use these groups to my advantage and have them yes. interact invisibly with each other?
Exactly. That's all it is. And, you know, whether it's a queer night or your own Doctor Who show or just at a weekend club, that's
exactly it,
everyone is doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's like how I was talking to someone last night about he asked me if I followed a football team, and I don't. I tried following many as a kid just for the sake of joining in with my brothers because they weren't at all into Doctor Who.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But now I've just sort of realised we are all exactly the same. You know, it is, you know, football fans don't like to admit it probably, but it is the exact same fan gene that we have.
Oh yeah.
And
wearing a football shirt is just cosplay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say we're probably more violent than them.
Have you heard about the socks thing at the Arsenal game?
What's the
this
socks
is not
thing?
Doctor Who related at all, but I found out about it this morning and it is absolutely hilarious. So Arsenal played Chelsea
mm-hmm.
Women's yesterday, and the match was delayed. So my flatmate's like really into women's football.
Mm-hmm.
Match delayed. She looks at her phone and it says because of a socks issue. And she's like, surely that's not right. Like, surely that's a typo. Or, and it turns out that so it was an away game, and Arsenal have shown up with the wrong socks on.
Do they have their home socks on?
They have the home socks on, and
no.
because of the rules of they had white socks, and Chelsea were wearing white socks, and you're not allowed to wear that. So
that's catastrophic.
They had to go to. The Chelsea like merch store in the ground and get the Chelsea away socks, which are like green or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the Arsenal players had to wear those. But before they put them on, people had to duct tape over the
sponsor
the Nike
logos.
Logo oh, no. because Arsenal is sponsored by Adidas.
So did they have to duct tape over it with three stripes just to... Is that how they did it?
Just like, this is the top league of women's football. Like, in the country, maybe the most prominent women's football league worldwide. And this is going on. I just thought it was so funny.
And it's being fixed with duct tape.
I mean, what do you do? Once you've made that
right.
fuck up, you're just there. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
God, football's tough, isn't it?
It's Have you seen, we were talking about the Amanda Iannucci shows before, there's
yes,
a sketch yeah. with the football. There's this bit about how he pretends to like football and he
yeah,
can't.
I think that was when I knew I was going to like the show yeah. because I have also trained myself to run as far away from the ball as possible and also have learned my own chants going,
and then he finds out that everybody's got a
little earpiece.
A little earpiece to tell them what to say.
Yeah,
about
and then
the
he
football.
Has the wires cut and suddenly they all stop talking because they're really... They're suddenly really freaked out. And then he goes and blends back in.
It's one of the things I miss, not to go all gender on you, but it's one of the things I miss the least about being a man is going to the hairdresser or getting in a taxi or meeting anyone, anyone, any man, and they go, oh, did you see the game? And you're like, ah. And now nobody asks me that because they look at me and they go, no, you didn't see the game.
See, I've just been able to navigate that with knitwear. It really just, no one...
God, I didn't need to change my gender. I could have just worn a jumper all this time.
It would have been so much easier. Ugh. Just go to some vintage shops.
Fuck.
Oh, no.
Who knew?
I'm really sorry to break this to you.
We've got Doctor Who news to talk about, Tom.
We have.
It was revealed yesterday that... first of all, before we talk about proper news,
yes.
let's talk about rumour news.
Okay.
Can we do that?
Yeah, I don't know if I know any rumours, but I'll see what I've got.
2024 Christmas special, penned by Stephen Moffat.
I don't buy it.
You don't buy it?
Yeah, I don't buy it.
I totally buy it.
Well, I do think... The reason I think Stephen Moffat has written Doctor Who for an upcoming series, and I don't know if it's a Christmas special. I don't think it's a Christmas special because Rusty Davis has already written about he is working on a Christmas special.
Oh, he has.
It's in Doctor Who magazine.
Yeah.
But I think Stephen Moffat has absolutely written Doctor Who for the new series. I can't prove it, but the reason I think he has is that he gave an interview ages ago when someone asked him, would he ever go back to Doctor Who?
Oh, and he said... Yeah, he said,
well, it wasn't he said he was a happy man. He said that, well, you have to bear in mind, Russell left a gap before coming back of, what, 13 years or however long it has been. And he was saying, but for me, it feels like yesterday. It feels like I was writing Doctor Who yesterday. And if any other person had said that in an interview, I would just take that as face value. But because it's him, I think he means it literally.
Yeah.
And I have a quote tweet ready in my drafts.
Do you?
Of that screen grab of that interview. And when it gets announced, I'm going to send that saying, knew it.
Oh, he's a little rascal.
I'm convinced he's written for the
series that's starting airing in May.
I have no idea if it's for this series. I'm convinced there is going to be some Doctor Who episode on TV in the next few years that he has written. And I'm convinced he has already been writing it and has talked about it in the interview. I think he was playing with us.
Isn't it mad that we've got two seasons of Doctor Who? I know the second one hasn't finished yet, but like sort of in the can.
Yeah.
And we've not seen either of them.
I know.
It's weird.
It is a really weird place to be.
Yeah.
I think what is really nice about it is, because I still think back to the sort of tail end of the Jodie era, which I didn't dislike as much as some people did. It also wasn't like my favourite. There were bits I really liked, bits I really didn't. But
I won't say a word.
Don't say a word. Yeah, I will say, no. Just to clarify, some people might be thinking I'm a monster or something. It's not because the writing was bad. I just hate women. That's the only reason I didn't like it. They're the worst. Terrible. Terrible. Terrible stuff.
Excellent.
It's not
the official position of the BBC.
I suppose it must be. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Well, she's gone, so we can only assume. No, why... did I say that? But I remember that sort of sense of, the anticipation that we all talk about as Doctor Who fans. And what I really loved was that once we knew there was already a future planned and a new showrunner, suddenly all the pressure comes off the episodes that are coming up because you know this isn't going to get it cancelled. There's already new stuff getting made. And
yes.
It's really nice knowing that far in advance. There's always something that's around the
Again,
corner.
That's not a normal
no,
thing to
it's
feel
not at all normal.
That, you know, I relate to that.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not how a person should feel about a television show. We shouldn't be watching it with anxiety. Because I feel like this about the Capaldi era, right? Mm. I love the Capaldi era now.
Yeah, yeah.
I it's some of my favourite Doctor Who of all. But at the time, I was really stressed during the Capaldi era, especially thinking about Series 9, which is not very palatable to the general public, especially the way it's marketed and just the
same old.
Yeah, you know, and you know, the series itself is dense and it's not people pleasing as a TV series at all.
No, it makes you do some of the work
exactly.
For it, yeah.
And at the time, that made me stressed, and now, I know that. Oh, Doctor Who's still on, you know, 10 years later.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about it. But we should just be able to enjoy it, shouldn't
we?
While it's happening in the moment.
I remember the first experience I had of watching an episode go out and thinking, yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it, but what if the public don't like it? And it was Planet of the Ood for some reason. I just thought, I thought that was great, but it was a bit grim. I think that might put off the casual viewer. What? Who is the casual viewer, Tom? What are you talking
it's
about?
Like
the casual viewer
needing,
is like 9 million people.
Needing reassurance from a partner that you'll still be with them in a year to enjoy sex with them now.
Yes.
Right?
It's exactly that, actually.
It's that.
Yes.
That's what it is.
Yes. It was a really difficult night cuddling up to the telly in bed that evening.
But no,
do you think
we
people
do,
will still love us?
We know it's not being cancelled. We know that it's on not only this year, but next year. And we now know that the first two episodes of the series are going to air together.
We do. That's the big news.
Yes.
The big news.
So let me get this straight in my head. It's going out on Disney Plus same time worldwide. Is this correct?
Yeah, it is going out Disney Plus the same time worldwide. In the UK, it is dropping on iPlayer at the same time corresponding to that, which means I think it starts in one of the US time zones. Apparently, they've got loads.
Okay.
I don't understand.
I've heard they've got loads.
I've heard the country is big. I don't know for sure.
Only got one, though.
Wow.
Wild.
That's insane.
It is mad, isn't it?
But that's communism for
you. That is communism for
you, yeah. Yeah, see, this is the capitalist system. You have loads of different times. That's just how it works. It's not geography. It's just, yeah. No. So it's dropping in the US at around about 7 p.m., but in the UK, that's going to be midnight.
I see.
So we've got the potential for...
So what you're telling me is they're prioritizing the Americans.
Yeah, I think they are. This is probably part of what has been talked about with the push for publicity is coming in, what, May for this first series. That is the worldwide push to turn Doctor Who into this global phenomenon, which it already has been, this is the effort to push it way further.
Well, I think it was more in the Stephen Moffat era.
Yes.
And then it fell off a bit in the Chibnall era, not even necessarily because of the quality, but just because...
Because the Americans hate women, yes.
Yeah, correct. Yes. Yeah. but no, I think... I mean, I will end up watching it at midnight. I just know I will. I don't want that to be me, but I know it will be me.
Well, I know what I'm going to do is that I'm going to watch it midnight, go to bed, and then watch it again on TX. I bet that is going to be loads and loads of fans.
So many people.
So while you've got the backlash going on now because it's something that's different and it's just what we do, I think it is going to be something that we all just get used to.
There's two going out at once. Will both air that night on BBC?
I think as far as I can make out, and I haven't read the press release because I'm lazy, but I think it's a Doctor Who double bill, then Eurovision, and then some other stuff. So that is sort of a perfect Saturday night.
It is in a way. I mean, I'm boycotting Eurovision this year for political reasons.
Look, I'm sorry. Just maybe May Muller just wasn't that good. We have to accept that.
But I'm not boycotting Doctor Who for political reasons, so I can enjoy that, thankfully.
I'm boycotting it. May Muller's in it. I just can't.
Stop it. wait, so that means that Doctor Who is only going to be on for 7 weeks?
It does.
Because it's an 8-episode series and if two are going out on the same day.
Yeah, so we're going to get 7 weeks
C and GCC maths. Here you go.
Oh, yeah. Nice. I never got that. But I think that's fine. That's a week longer than Flux.
That is a week longer than Flux. To be fair, like Doctor Who always had way more episodes than other shows anyway.
And
like,
also, if we are,
we can't expect a 13 episode season.
No, it's just TV isn't the same now as it was then. And I know that I had this as well when it was announced that Ossie Davis was coming back. There's that gene that kicks in from your teenage self going, "Oh wow, it's going to be on at Saturday nights on BBC One again," and. Like, I think to an extent that's going to be true, but there are going to be changes because of how TV works now.
For sure.
And I think people are... One of the concerns that I've seen online is that people are nervous that, you know, something going out at midnight is not as good for... You know, that's not family viewing time. But I think...
But it's not going out at midnight. It's going out at 7. And
yeah, it's going out at 7, which is still the time for
kids. And people
kids
who
to watch
are
it.
Obsessed with it will watch it at midnight.
Yeah.
And kids who love it but are not obsessed with it will watch it at 7. And
no,
that's
absolutely.
Fine.
And I think that's absolutely fine. And I think from a parent's point of view as well, if you're nervous that is this show going to be too scary for my kid, you then have a whole day before it actually goes out
so
to look
true.
Online
to look at it.
So in many ways it probably makes it more family friendly now.
Yeah.
And you do have that communal experience of watching it at the same time if you want it, which I think has always been a bit of an illusion because you are aware that you're watching it at the same time when it goes out. And I do have that feeling when I watch it go out live, and catching up on iPlayer does feel different.
Yeah.
But all of us watching it together, it's always something that you just have in your, you know, that's just how your own mind is working as you're watching that episode, because you're not literally in the same room as loads of other people.
Yeah, for sure.
Like you can have some sort of viewing party if you want. But what I tend to think of is, you know, 10 years ago they found 9 missing Troughton episodes and they all went out at midnight and we all downloaded them and watched them and we had an incredible time enjoying that and soaking it up. And it was so celebratory. So I don't think it's something that people need to be worried about, but we're fans and we have to do something to occupy the time, so why not pick a scheduling change?
Yeah, I think that's okay.
Yeah, I'm fine with
it. I'm not worried about it too much. The thing that bothers me more is the Disneyification of Doctor Who. You know, the...
Why is Millie Gibson dressed as the Sorcerer's Apprentice now? It's not right.
But it's the, you know, the issue with it for me is the, you know, Disney Doctor Who, and
I think it's a scary thing when
it's a bit frightening.
It's a scary thing when, you know, you see another brand that you already know as its own thing sort of comes towards our thing. But I think,
well, because Disney have got they're nearing a monopoly now in the entertainment market.
Yeah,
it feels sad that they've now got my thing too.
Yeah,
I mean, they don't own the copyright to Doctor Who. But
no, but I can understand that sort of fear. And I think as fans, you know, you do feel very protective of it. And again, this is just like how we're exactly the same as football fans. You know, football fans are really scared when an American comes and buys their team.
Oh, I mean, that ship sailed, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but in many ways, perhaps that ship has sailed here too. Like, I think back to it now and, you know, I had that sort of, I was talking about just then, that sort of nostalgic thing coming and going, oh great, so maybe Saturday nights can be saved, maybe linear TV is saved. And actually, no, that ship has probably sailed in a lot of ways as well. You know, you'll still see big events come up like Eurovision that will bring people watching TV at the same time together. And the fact that Doctor Who is part of that night now shows that it still has its part to play in that. But
I think
it's
drama
also
is just
gonna
always
going
to be different, though, to something like Eurovision.
It's
or something
very
like,
rare that a drama has that kind
of like
reach.
Love Island or, you know, reality television where people want to see results. And it's just a whole, you know, even football, like we're using football as a comparison in a sort of tongue-in-cheek way. But I think actually, like, if I miss Doctor Who on point of broadcast, which I actually quite regularly do because I'm a person with a social life and it's on a Saturday night.
Oh, what's it like?
You know, and if I miss it, I'll watch it when I get in, or I'll watch it the next day, and I'll you know, turn my Twitter off, and I'll avoid spoilers, and I'll watch it, and that's fine. If you know, my dad, for example, is a huge Manchester City fan, as well as being a Doctor Who fan. If he were to miss a Manchester City match on the TV or on the radio, he's not going to watch or listen to it and catch up. He's going to watch highlights or read about it. It's for him, there's pretty much zero value in sitting through the whole 90 minutes after everybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that is really where event television, like sport and like reality television and like music programming, like Eurovision, really differs from drama.
Yes, that's definitely true. And you can
nobody's watching the whole 1966 World Cup final recreationally. I mean, I might. I'm sure people are.
Did Network ever release that on DVD?
I'm sure people are, but it's your average football fan is not.
No, definitely. And drama is very different. But you can see in how the viewing figures work now. You know, overnight is still healthy, but you know, you're looking at least half, but usually a lot more is coming to it after the event on catch-up.
For sure. Yeah.
But also, I mean, I'm still thinking back to how I got into Doctor Who as a kid. Like, you know, I was seeing stories that had been on decades ago. And I was buying them on VHS, and that is how I discovered that show and got into it. I mean, I think the best way to debut the new series is to put it out at 7 a.m. on UK Gold. And I will record that. We'll pause it for the advert break.
Yeah.
I want it all as an omnibus. I want both episodes just together. Cut out the credits. Don't need them. Don't care who's playing that character. Don't care.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many different ways that over the years people have discovered this show. And I think, you know, the thing that you always have to worry about is whether new audiences are coming on board. And I think, you know, this isn't gonna make that less likely.
No, definitely not. Because also people will go back and they'll watch the old stuff. Because if you look at like top shows on streaming, it's stuff like Gilmore Girls and Friends and stuff.
Yes,
people
go back to
and that's
it
not just people rewatching it. That's
new people.
My little sister's 14. And she and her like Bezzy mate are rewatching all of these like 90s sitcoms. Well, I say rewatching, not rewatching, watching for the first time.
Yes.
Because they're suggested to them on Netflix and they'll watch them. And that's fine.
Yeah.
That's great.
And that's lovely and it's exciting. And now
and
they can do that
happen
with Doctor Who as well.
Yeah, with Eccleston, Tennant.
What do you think?
And they're more like to watch it in order. whereas you and I would have like dipped in and out of video cassettes, watched it completely chaotically.
Yeah.
Whereas these kids have got a list of, and they can even go, okay, maybe I'll dip into Sarah Jenovich's in between.
Do you think there are there are 8-year-olds out there right now about to watch The Sensorites for the first time? Can you? Isn't that a beautiful thing?
Call Childline. Yeah. So before you go, Tom, I wanted to ask you about Blue Peter.
Please do.
Because that's your day job. Right?
It is.
And Blue Peter has a special relationship with Doctor Who, much like the UK and US governments. Like we mentioned earlier, like there's clips of Doctor Who that survive because of Blue Peter.
Yes, yes.
Blue Peter has run all manner of Doctor Who segments and interviews. What are some of your favourite Doctor Who Blue Peter collabs from over the years?
Well, I have to single out, because it was such a huge experience for me aged 8, in, what was I, 7? However old I was. 1999, there was an episode of Blue Peter where the opening title started as normal, but then suddenly it turned into the Doctor Who theme. And
love it.
I've talked about this on another excellent podcast, Box of Delights with Julia Rayside. Listen to that too after this for more details, please.
Cool.
But it felt like somebody had made a piece of TV that was just for me. Because I was the only kid in that class who was watching Doctor Who, who was getting these VHSs, who was going to the video crypt.
And you're watching Blue Peter going, who's this aimed at? I'm not the target audience.
Who's done this? Why? What do they hope to gain?
Why had they done a Doctor Who special?
I think partly because there were people on the team who loved it.
Right.
But also,
who's
there
hosting this time? Is it pre-Hook?
It was presented by Connie Huck, Stuart Miles, and Katie Hill.
Okay.
And it was being edited by, I want to say, Oliver McFarlane, but the producer for the episode was Richard Marson, who was the editor of Blue Peter in the first Rusty Davis era. So Richard Marson was behind the Designer Monster competition, the Winner Part in Doctor Who competition. That was his era.
I see.
So for that reason, I'm also going to pick a lot of that era as well for our, the top collabs. Gethin going to be a Scythe Man being a Dalek as well.
Yeah.
Love and Monsters is the ultimate Blue Peter Doctor Who collaboration. And I love that episode.
I got to get Will Grantham for this podcast. I need to talk to him.
I want to know what's happening. I was campaigning.
He's a YouTuber now and everything, right?
He is, isn't he? I was lobbying behind the scenes when we did our Doctor Who competition on Blue Peter last year. I was lobbying to get him as one of the judges. I was so determined. I wanted to get him back. I wanted it to be a whole nostalgia fest, but it was too niche. So sad.
What was the competition last year?
The competition was to create a piece of fan art to celebrate 60 years of Doctor Who. And the prize of that was you basically got to the winning child got to be one of the first people to go onto the new TARDIS set.
Cool.
So the winner, Verity, who was named after Verity Lambert, because mum was a fan as well. She got to go on the TARDIS, I think, after the specials had been made, but the set was obviously still up there, and they went on to the TARDIS set as I think it looked at sort of the end of the giggle.
Love it.
So they got to see all of that stuff. They got to go and look at, I think they got to hold a Wrath Warriors gadget. They
so
got
sick.
To, yeah, I think they got to see. What's really nice is I think you can see it on the winning competition VT, and it's on YouTube, so you can still find it, is you can see a 3D printed model of that TARDIS set, which is, I think, one of the various tools they use to put that whole thing together. But for a kid to be able to do that before it's even gone on telly, it was
so cool.
It was incredible.
Yeah, blimey.
And obviously a very closely guarded secret. So, that's a big responsibility for Blue Peter to bear, that special relationship that those two shows have. It comes at a price for Blue Peter because you have to really protect that stuff. And you,
for sure.
Because you, the last
which
thing
must
you
be
would
kind
want.
Of an unusual thing for a show like Blue Peter, which usually is not having to it's not having to be so cloak and dagger.
No, normally not, but this was people got how special and how important this was. And what a good prize is, because it's on the cusp of this new era as well.
For sure.
It was so, so exciting.
Such a cool prize.
So yeah, those are some of my favourites. I also love the Dalek cakes.
Design gadgets for the Paternoster gang.
Yes, which was, I think that might have been the last competition we did before this one. So that's a decade gap. So we were overdue for it, I think. So I'm glad it actually worked out.
That's cool.
Hooray. And that Doctor Who badge that was created and went out to the top 500 of that competition. I think
top 500.
The top 500 entries of the Doctor Who competition last year received one of those Doctor Who badges, which is
that's a lot of entries.
A lot of entries, yeah.
How many entries in total?
It was in the thousands. That much I can tell you.
Wow. Yeah.
But I love the design of that. It was the diamond logo, which had, but with the Blue Peter ship in the center of the O, the big O. And I can also tell you a very fun Doctor Who Blue Peter fact. That Doctor Who badge was designed by a member of our team called Matt Smith.
Cool.
Not that one. I tend to think that Doctor Who has a Matt Smith. We have
the Matt Smith,
Smith, who designed the Doctor Who Blue Peter badge.
Yeah, that's so cool.
It's lovely. It's a lovely
thing. And then
of
course there was the winner part in Doctor Who, which was, he's called John. Is he called John, the kid who won that?
Yes, John Bell, who is John now Bell. Professional actor. Is he an Outlander? I think he's still doing loads of stuff now.
Cool.
And it's amazing. You know, you can look at what winning a Blue Peter competition does.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
What will happen to little Verity in 20 years' time? What's she going to be doing?
Well, I remember not applying for that because I would have been exactly the right age for it. And I remember, I think my grandma had read about it in the newspaper or something, and she was like, apply for this and blah, blah, blah. And reading all of the criteria and downloading the script you had to read and all of this. And then just never got round to it, because actually nowadays those kinds of things are dead easy. But back then, this would have been 2006.
Yeah, it's on when it's at the cutting edge.
Uploading a video and sending it into Blue Peter was not very easy.
Yeah, with a digital camera or maybe a camera
phone
if you've got one of the
new ones. Or it was like, my dad being a bit like, I think your Uncle Peter's got a camcorder, maybe we could borrow that.
So it must have been a challenge, a difficult one. I think my guess will be that will have had fewer entries, certainly, than the Designer Monster one, which I think...
Oh, because Designer Monster...
Well, that is one of the biggest competitions I think Blue Peter has had in its whole history.
Really?
That had something like, I want to say 43,000 entries.
Fuck off, really?
It was insane.
Wow.
Insane number of entries. And, you don't see numbers like that every single competition you run. Like, that's incredible.
And did Russell judge that?
He did, yes.
So is that him going, okay, I've basically written Love and Monsters. I know what the function of the character in the story is going to be. I'm going to look through a few thousand of these monsters and see which one fits my brief.
I'm genuinely not actually sure whether the script came first and the monster fitted it, or if the monster was picked and the script was developed. Because, this was a time when it wasn't being made, 2 years in advance.
Sure.
So it could be that it was quite... you are dealing with someone who can write midnight over a weekend. So,
You could adapt that Love and Monster story to lots of different kinds of characters. Aspect of it, you can write that in. And
I would love to see the version of Love and Monsters with Sad Tony, which was an entry that did not win.
Sad Tony.
Sad Tony. I think this is... I can't remember what this is covered in, but a kid designed a monster called Sad Tony.
Wow.
And I can't remember what the special powers were of Sad Tony. Possibly it just makes everyone else sad. I'm not sure.
Blimey.
But there is photographic evidence. If you go on, just search online, just type in Sad Tony, Doctor Who, Blue Peter into a search engine, and a picture is there, and it will come up. I think it might have some kind of...
I'm going to do it right now.
Yes, do it right now. Funnily enough, I think there was a period when... you do these things where you go through therapy and you try and deal with things to help manage your mental health. And one of the things you can do is to try and, you might refer to your depression as the black dog or something. For a period, I had quite depressive spells and I referred to my depression as Sad Tony.
Sad Tony's round. It's got a TARDIS wiki page.
It has got a TARDIS wiki page and a well-deserved one too. I love Sad Tony.
Sad Tony.
There is a parallel universe where Love and Monsters has Sad Tony in it. And I'd love to see that episode. I want to see
how it gets changed. But would you still cast Peter
Emily
Kay?
From Sandbach.
Sandbach. Well, not that far from here.
It's not very far from here at all. You go on the train.
Yeah.
The crew train stops in Sandbach.
Exactly. Get the crew train.
So this character appears in a... Oh, I see. This was in like a lockdown webcast that Emily Cook did.
Yes.
So that's why it's got a TARDIS.
I completely forgot that Sad Tony is used in that. It'll be the Love of Monsters tweet along, won't you?
Yeah. Another entry from the 2006 competition, fan favourite runner-up Sad Tony.
So much good stuff came from those
Made a cameo in the webcast. Sad, I had a thing called the Worry Monster, which a therapist encouraged me to make when I was a child, and it was this sort of purple blob with fangs and little spindly arms.
And did you send that into the BBC?
That was just for me.
That's a shame.
But when I was 19, I did write a one-act play about the Worry Monster, where a girl played the monster wearing purple balloons, and I took it to the Fringe with my university theatre society. And it was a bomb. Absolute disaster. One night we had one guy in the audience. The reviews were dreadful. I still remember the worst review it got, which was also the first review it got. One star. And the final line of the review of the play, which was called The Worry Monster, was, I'm worried. Very worried about the message this is sending out. You know, I feel like as creative people, you've got to go through these things, though, haven't you?
Oh, you absolutely do, because I remember the first review that Stableface ever got was one star. But luckily, it was incredibly badly written, and they hadn't stopped to think about denying us any pull quotes, because they wrote, for all I know, these guys could be the next Monty Python, and that's all you need. The next Monty Python, in quotes.
Excellent.
Yes, putting on show after show to fund our various divorces.
That's so good.
Yeah.
I'm worried, very worried. That was the thing is with my one, that bad review was, it was the worst review got, and it was also the best written review got. So it was kind of annoyingly the review I respected the most.
That's frustrating.
Do you know what I mean? Some of the more glowing reviews were from like student newspapers, people who knew members of the cast,
yeah,
you know.
I hate a five star. That's my least favourite kind. I don't feel like I've earned that.
It sort of feels a bit dirty, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. I mean, I'll take it, but I don't feel good
about
it.
I'll take it and I'll put it on the poster. Yeah, but
absolutely.
You know, when you go, this person has sort of missed the point of the show, but they give me five stars, so.
Yeah, it'll do. It'll do.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom. It's been lovely.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and thank you for having me, and thank you also, James Goss, for everything.
Yeah, thank you, Daddy.
don't forget me.
Where can people find you and your work?
You can find Peter Fleming. I think the best way to find Peter Fleming is going on your podcast
just
provider.
Just going out into the street and shouting.
Yeah, just, Peter, where are you? Yeah. I will appear. Go on to your local podcast provider and type in Into the Archives with Peter Fleming. And that is your best way to discover Peter Fleming.
Lovely. And you can follow the podcast on Instagram at GalacticYoyoPod_. You can follow me on Instagram at MullyMartian_. And I'll be back next week for more podcast fun. See you soon, everybody.